I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode 4 of Tom Lucy Plus One. My name is Tom Lucy, and I will be your host for this evening's entertainment. For those of you who don't know, I am a comedian, and I've been doing that for about 4 or 5 years. And now I do this podcast where I chat to people from the world of entertainment. And our guest this week is Adam Kay, who is a fantastic writer, comedy writer, and now author. He wrote a book which came out, I think, last year called This Is Going to Hurt, which was about the NHS, and it's done hugely well and been one of the top sellers of the year. So we talk about that and lots of other stuff in this week's episode. So a big thank you to Adam Kay for coming on. He kindly invited me around to his house in West London, and we had a great chat. So here it is, the brilliant Adam Kay.
Sure? I thought more than 20 seconds ahead of... Were my spiders up on the wall? They weren't. Have you seen the spiders? Do you like spiders?
No.
No.
Oh, yeah. What, are they real?
Yeah.
No, they're not. Are they real?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Those are non-small spiders, aren't they?
Adam, that's disgusting.
Is it?
Yeah.
Just look at the butterflies then.
Okay. And the bugs as well.
Yeah.
Oh, my Adam, look at the size of it.
It was like A4.
Where did you buy that?
From a shop in Brighton.
Is that what the Turner Prize looks like?
Yeah.
So you get that from the book.
It's just a shop that sells really expensive things. And it was the most expensive thing they had, so I thought, have it!
Where's the shop?
Brighton, North Lambs.
Oh, okay.
It's amazing, it's full of... There's loads of taxidermy and sort of and mounted insects and things.
Mounted insects?
Yes. I mean, mounted onto a board, you know, with a bit of pin for it, rather than fucked insects.
Fucked insects sounds like a good name for a shop.
Yeah.
Or a nightclub.
Or a podcast.
Maybe we should call it.
What's the podcast called?
It's called Tom Lucy Plus One.
Okay.
You seem very sceptical about this.
Oh, I just don't know the world needs it. But if you promise me they do, then I'm happy. I don't know, it's like using plastic straws or something. It's something that people start needing to make a stand against.
Do you not like listening to podcasts?
I don't actually listen to a lot of podcasts, but I don't like when Facebook tells me that someone's got a podcast.
But I think, I've spoken to other people about this, it's because all of our friends are comedians and it seems like everyone's making podcasts, but it's not normal people, I don't think, would think that.
Yeah. Also, I get asked to do a lot of podcasts and say that also. I generally say no, although yesterday I said yes to one.
Which one?
And what was her name? She was very nice. And she was called Jessica Foster.
Oh, yeah, I know Jess, yeah.
And it was actually very interesting because she just ordered loads of food to the house and we just ate and talked about food.
Is that what the podcast that was the is about?
Yeah, it's called Hoovering. It's talking about just eating and stuff.
It's called Hoovering?
Yeah, it's like Hoovering food.
Oh, right.
And so, yeah, that was... and so the pitch was, there's going to be loads of food. It's just like, I'm in.
Does that not make it sound a bit weird on the...
Oh, yeah, it must sound disgusting. But it's not my problem. I'm going to listen to it, am I?
Because I think the interviews I've heard where people have been eating, it always sounds...
Oh, yeah.
Horrific.
Yeah. Also, there was a man with a pickaxe taking an enormous dry stone wall to bits.
Did you do it at your house here?
Yeah.
So this week has just been a succession of people coming in to interview you for podcasts.
Yes. But, I mean, I do lots of interviews, but not normally podcasts. So I did the Richard Herring one. That was one.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That wasn't a really podcast. That's like... someone who can't interview speaking to you on stage in front of 400 people. So that's
I like that podcast. Who else was on it on the night you did it?
Kathy Burke.
Oh, she's great.
Yeah, no, she's great.
When was that? Was that a while ago?
Start of Feb, I think.
Okay. One of the things, seamless link, that I wanted to talk to you about...
And we've restarted recording?
Yeah, it
was. Oh, shit!
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I can cut all that
I don't know. Some of that might have been off the record.
No, that's okay.
I probably shouldn't mention the other podcast. But I'm happy to be on the record with there are too many young white male comedians doing podcasts.
I agree.
You're going to bring it down from the inside.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. I don't know, because I felt like that for a long time, but I think the problem is comedians talking to comedians.
Which is
do you think there's too many of those?
I think there's too many comedians.
Here's an interesting question. Would you say would you call yourself a writer or a comedian?
Yeah, I call myself a writer.
A writer.
Because I barely gig, and it's sort of... I've never really been on the circuit and stuff like that. And I'm gigging a bit at the moment to support this stupid book, this amazing book. And I think of myself as a writer. That's what pays the bills. You know, sort of.
Yeah.
99% of what I do is writing scripty stuff.
Was there ever a time when you were like, your main thing was gigging, or has it always been like a side?
Side hustle. No, there were about 2 years when I left medicine.
Mm.
And before I tricked production companies into employing me, I was mostly gigging, but I was mostly doing like weird medical corporate gigs for like pharmaceutical companies and hospitals and all that sort of.
And why was that? Because you did jokes about medical things.
Yeah, so I at medical school I'd done bits. I'd started doing songs, and I was known a bit as like a recording artist doing those sort of, sort of lowest common denominator smutty songs on a medical theme. And when I stumbled out of medicine needing to pay the gas bill, I sort of thought I would double down on that. Because obviously when you're working 100 hours a week as a doctor, you can't really do that much gigging.
No.
When you can't predict what time your shift's going to end or when it's going to be. So I did a bit of, a couple of years of that. And oh my God. Corporates are no fun, though.
No.
How deep are you into that world?
Not that deep. Not balls deep, as I imagine you are. I've done a few corporate-y things, but they're not fun, are they?
They're harder work, because a win in a corporate, I think, is if half the people are listening half the time.
Yeah.
You know, when it's 10:30 and at night and they've been hammered with, and they want to talk to their mates, if you can just maintain their attention.
Would you do the same thing, the same sort of set that you would do in the normal
No.
Do you have like a corporate set?
Totally. And it, yeah, it's about tailoring it to the, to the people. It's about doing loads of homework beforehand. And really work. But so I got very good at doing a very strange type of gig.
Yeah.
And then when I sort of then later down the line was taking a show to Edinburgh or whatever, or doing a tour show in theatres, I was like, oh wow, this is great.
Yeah. Because you were used to performing to
people with their, at best, their arms folded. And at worst, loudly talking to their friends.
Maybe, I suppose that would have been similar to if you had done... Did you do open mics and...
No, I sort of...
Did you miss that whole
thing? I missed that, so I'm doing the sort of Benjamin Button version of comedy. starting in at corporates, and then now I'm working my way down through big theatre shows. hopefully, if everything goes to plan, I'll be bothering...
what's that?
Mirth Control in 5 years or so.
Cavendish Arms.
Fingers crossed.
That's great. I would love to have not have had to do all that.
You don't have to.
Do you think? I've never spoken to anyone who's not had to do...
Oh, but also, at the same time, my caveat is I don't know anything about the life of a comedian or what career progression involves.
One of the things that I think about strongly when I think of you, so, I mean, this is as a compliment, is you a complete sort of lack of interest in stand-ups and stand-up. You don't seem to have any desire to be a stand-up, or quite often when we've spoken in the past and I've told you what I'm up to, you sort of question why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Well, you're often doing terrible things, but, you know.
And then I remember once explaining to me what your life is like as a writer, and it sounds great. You just can work from home and there's no travelling really.
And drunk and naked. Things that you can't do on
as
stage.
As we are now.
At the Cavendish Arms.
Yeah. Or yeah. Maybe you could do as your last gig at the Cavendish Arms.
Yeah. One of the things that was difficult about medicine is not being in control of your life.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be in a situation ever again where I'm not in control of my life. And if my job's, you know, writing or script editing scripts of my own or other people, then I choose which job to say yes or no to. I choose how many days a week I work, where I work from. Yeah, and I like working from home. That's my thing.
Was that always, was your sort of life now always what you wanted?
No, I don't think I've got any... I don't think I've ever really had any plan other than a sort of a plan age, you know, in teenage to be a doctor, which I made good on. And then that's just a sort of a production line until you become a consultant at the end. But since I left, I haven't really planned things, but I've always done things I've been interested in. I've never taken jobs where I didn't think I'd learn something, I guess. Like, I've got no interest, if I've written on series one of a show, I've got no great interest in doing series two of that show because I've learnt what I can through it, and I prefer to do different types of things because also I don't like working on the same show for 5 days a week. I'll generally only do three or four and take like a day on something completely different, or take a day off just so I don't
that's great.
You should totally do it. I mean, your writing needs to improve quite a lot first. but you know, if you can sort that out, then they should totally do it.
Do you think that most comedians think they could write and they couldn't do it? Do you think people think it's a skill that they could do, but actually, I've really badly phrased that question.
No, I get it. It's not necessarily the case that because you're even a brilliant stand-up comedian, you'll either be able to be an actor or a narrative script writer.
Yeah.
Because jokes are important in comedy, but basically comedies are about characters
and
putting the characters into situations and caring about them. And it's possible to bring someone in. You know, I do, it's one of the things I do a fair amount, being brought into a show to gag it up, to, you know, chuck some jokes in. What you can't do is retrofit emotion or the meaning of the show. And so,
yeah,
a lot of comedians make brilliant writers, some make terrible writers, and yeah, also some very unfunny people who you'd never want to see on stage in a billion years make phenomenal writers. You sort of, you meet some comedy writers and you're like, seriously? And then, you know, and then you work with them in a, you know, writing, yeah, room, or see stuff they've done, you're like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's, I always like the bit of the BAFTAs or the Emmys or these award shows where they present the award for writing, or, and you see the writers go up on stage and they always look like every single type of person, like just this mismatch of, you know, like this the group at school that maybe would have been bullied.
Oh yeah,
that's what it looks like.
It's like the X-Men stripped of their powers, isn't it?
And you think, I think I like these. That's my crowd. I like those people.
Yeah,
is that how it feels?
No, you're definitely weird enough to be a writer.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. I think you could do it.
I don't know, it's weird. Do you think that your background as a doctor has helped your career in writing? Do you think it helped to do something different before and then come to it late?
Yeah, I think maturity is no bad thing in terms of being able to... You've met more people, you've had more experiences. I think sort of age probably helped. Until recently, I'd never really written about being a doctor, because I wanted, yeah, to prove that I was, you know, I'm not just a guy who used to be a doctor, I'm like a proper writer of my own.
So
I think it helps on stage. I think I'm reasonably fearless,
yeah,
because there's never any life or death situations,
yeah,
on stage. You know, the most stressful stuff that will ever happen to you in your life has already happened to you if you've worked on Labour Ward for 7 years.
Yeah, I didn't think of it like that, yeah.
So the stakes are so much lower.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the, you know, if you're doing that sort of regional radio and they say, oh, it must be so scary getting, you know, how do you do it? How do you control it? It's one of the sort of the boilerplate basic questions. And when you've already done something day in, day out, that's much worse.
Yeah.
So I think it helps for...
Puts a perspective on it.
Bit of perspective, yeah.
Do you find it sort of funny how when comedians get very nervous about things and you think it doesn't really matter?
No, because we've all got our own. I was exactly that when I started in medicine.
Yeah.
You know, I got faint with blood. You sort of, and it's the same thing in comedy. It doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, you learn eventually that excitement helps, but nerves don't, and so you manage to get rid of them a bit.
So I've just, it's because when you were growing up, was it when you were sort of, you know, a teenager, were you equally as into, you know, the medicine as comedy, or did you always want to be a doctor or a comedian? Or
I don't really know what I was. I didn't go into medicine for any good reasons other than there were lots of doctors in my family, and it was like the,
right,
you know, the default position to, you know, go into. It was my marimba ringtone. It's what I came preset with, unless I had another idea. So because I didn't come up with a better plan, I ended up being a doctor. Comedy, I'd always written like funny stuff. I was like editor of our school newspaper and sort of school magazine and wrote lots of funny pieces. Or,
yeah.
I say funny, I mean, I'm sure they were just dog shit, weren't they? But I sort of stuff, I've tried to do that. I did like sort of sketchy stuff on stage and wrote for other people who were performing, and just, I was interested in that.
Yeah.
Because I was sort of growing up in an environment where you become a doctor or a lawyer or a politician or a civil servant and not much else, it hadn't occurred to me that being a writer or a comedian was really a thing, because, you know,
yeah,
you don't get your monthly salary if you're a you know, a writer. So it didn't, sort of hadn't really computed.
Do you come from a family of people, doctors, lawyers?
Yeah, so my family's doctors, So basically, you choose to be a doctor when you choose your A-levels. Because every medical school wants you to have certain A-levels. And so when you're choosing your A-levels, when you're 16, that's a very bad age to decide anything, obviously.
It's mad, that, isn't it, that you have to choose at 16?
Yeah.
That you want to be a doctor?
Absolute nonsense. And like,
is it such a case that, like, if you were 22, you just couldn't do it? If you decided to be a doctor at 22?
It's increasingly you can do it as a postgraduate career.
But that's
rare. America gets medicine almost completely wrong, but it's generally a postgraduate degree.
Right.
Which is good because you can make an informed decision.
At 21.
Exactly. Rather than just being, you know, a young teenager.
Yeah.
Doing it on the basis of your dad's a doctor, you quite like Holby City. And of the two, liking like Holby City is actually probably a better reason.
I suppose. Did you watch Holby City growing up? How long has Holby City been on TV?
I don't know. Well, that was sort of, it grew out of casuality, didn't it? And which is still going, but I think Holby City is probably a funnier phrase, isn't it?
Yeah. So we're learning some writing lessons. So you at 16, well, I'm going to be a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Nothing in you want... Were you thinking about wanting to be a comedian or...?
I was thinking about being a musician. So I was really good at the saxophone and pretty good at the piano. Mm. But it was basically pointed out to me...
saxophone.
Yeah, what's funny about that?
Really?
Am I not cool enough to play the saxophone?
I've never seen you play saxophone.
Why would you have seen me ever play the saxophone?
Well, I'd say we're pretty good friends.
But I don't play the saxophone social situations.
I suppose that would be strange if I'd seen you. I've never even heard you talk about a saxophone. Have you got one here?
Yeah, there's one in the house. Do I need to go and get a saxophone?
No, it's fine. I'm not going to put you on the spot and make you play saxophone on the podcast.
I mean, I would. I'd play you out back in Baker Street.
So saxophone and what was the other one? Piano.
And trombone. I was like a music nerd. But...
Yeah, the nerd.
And I thought that I could... But I thought I could be like a sort of... an amazing sort of famous... Whoever famous saxophonist. Bach was famously not a saxophonist.
Oh, so I thought you meant piano player.
And nor was he a famous piano player.
He a piano player.
thanks for playing.
Well, it was Bach.
He was a composer, wasn't he?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm going to say Kenny G for your demographic.
I don't know who that is.
I mean, he's the most famous saxophonist we can really...
Did he do Baker Street?
He didn't, no. Baker Street, the saxophonist Baker Street recently died. There was an urban myth that it was Bob Holness who did the...
I don't know who that is either.
Oh, really? He was the presenter of Blockbusters. But anyway, I don't know what
Blockbusters is. I don't know any of these references.
Oh, shit.
I do know who a saxophonist is. Clarence Clemens.
Okay.
From the E Street Band.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I thought I could be
Clarence Clemens. Okay.
It turns out... That even though I was the best saxophone player in my school, that probably meant I was the 9 millionth best saxophone player in the world, and I wouldn't end up playing professional saxophone. I would end up probably teaching music, and you can probably understand from my temperament. A teacher's played the most crucial role, but I'm not a teacher.
I can't imagine you playing saxophone.
Patience. And don't particularly like children.
I wouldn't want to be taught anything by you.
No one would.
You're quite
mean,
short tempered with your people you like. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I can only imagine what a class of young saxophonists would think.
you never learned an instrument then, did you?
Well, I did.
Did you learn it in a class? Because it's generally one-to-one.
Well, at high school, we had a thing where, when we were like 8, we had to choose if we wanted to do violin or recorder. They were the options. And I chose violin.
Okay.
And learned that for like 6 months and got bored and then started learning guitar. And learned that for about 4 years and then got bored. My life up to this point has been a succession of getting obsessed with things and then losing interest. So I was like...
We're all waiting to see when this one loses its shine, Tom.
Hopefully the comedy thing will burn out quite soon.
Yeah.
But I remember...
What's next? What's up next?
I went through, like, guitar was a massive thing. Then it was magic. I was really into magic for, like...
Were you?
2 years. Yeah.
No.
And I was learning, and I obsessed with it, and... Oh, and then I completely lost interest in that, and then it became comedy. Acting was before comedy.
Oh, no.
Why, do you think I should have been a magician?
Well, no.
The other day in Cardiff shouted Stephen Mulhern at me. On stage. Right. I was on stage.
That's the cruelest hacker, listen to
it. Yeah, they just shouted Stephen Mulhern. I didn't really know who it was. I had to Google it. He's a magician.
But he's a presenter
yeah.
slash musician mm. slash... presumably closet homosexual.
Mm. We haven't got this out.
Oh yeah, that's not staying in, is it? I said presumably, and no, yeah, that's yeah. not enough, though, is it?
Okay. Here's because we'll have to cut. We'll cut that from there.
Okay. Acast will.
I have.
Make sure that's.
Joel will cut that out. Joel's the guy who edits these. Can you believe there's someone who works editing this?
Hi, Joel.
I
haven't been very funny yet. Can you up your question game a bit?
Saxophone stuff was good.
I'll get a saxophone and I'll play you out on it.
Oh, that would be good. Let's do that.
Okay. We can do Baker Street.
That's great. We'll do that. That's great. When I spoke, some of the people I've been talking to on this podcast, we've talked about the getting...
Can I just guess that Joel isn't going to enjoy the amount of time you hit your legs and the table? Just from an editing point of view, the occasional... That's what they dream of.
That's not me hitting Adam. That's me laughing at Adam. At Adam. We've talked a lot about writer's block with other people.
Oh, yes.
Is that something you experience?
Yes.
Right. I presume it is.
It is.
Yeah.
Having
looked at some of your work, I presume.
Yes. Yeah, there's you've read a lot that's written on down days.
Yeah, yeah. It's what we're all thinking.
So what I've got better at is realizing a day where it's just not coming, and then abandoning the day and doing something completely different.
Saxophone.
Yeah. Just
taking out the saxophone.
Yeah, the saxophone, and, but you know, just going to the. Going to the cinema, walking around the park, just meeting someone for drinks or dinner, because I find that if I try and push against a closed door, nothing pretty much happens, and then by the end of that, I'm just hugely frustrated. But if I just give my brain a day off and just do some fun stuff, next day I'm normally in a good place. I've never, luckily, touch wood so far, had like weeks and weeks where I just couldn't write. But sometimes I just start and I'm like,
Do you think it's one of those things, because some of the people I've spoken to have said that being at home is where they feel like they can work. And some people say that's the worst thing for them and they need to get out and go away. And being at home is really bad for writing and...
Distraction is very bad for me, so I'm very bad at writing during the day.
Right.
Obviously, writing rooms with other people, you know, they generally insist that I don't do it at 3 a.m.
Are you not at a level where you can just demand it's at 3 in the morning?
I've never asked the question, but I suspect the answer is I'm not at the level. also, my worry would be I'd reduce the pool of people I can call on to you.
Sure.
As I say. my best writing time, if I'm, you know, working on a script on my own or script editing or a book or something, is from about 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. Those are my golden hours, because Twitter's fucked off to bed and Facebook's fucked off a bit and no one's gonna text me and I can't self-destruct by just, you know, texting a friend to say should we go out for drinks, because the answer would be I'm asleep or it's 2 a.m. and everything's shut.
Who are you?
Yeah, who are you? Yeah. So that's when I work best, and I write by pacing around a lot.
Mm. I can only imagine what that looks like.
Do you want me to do that? Okay. So I'm
okay.
Start. Start about here.
Yeah.
This is a, I mean, this is a fairly
is
long
in
room.
This room as well?
No, sort of, this is my pacing circuit.
Oh my word.
We'll go down to the end of this room.
Yeah.
And then go through this door. That through.
It's quite a long circuit, really.
Yeah, that's my pacing circuit.
Is this
the
table where you sit at and then you get
it
up
is,
and do that?
Yeah. Normally that chair.
Amazing, isn't it?
I don't think it's actually even interesting, let alone amazing.
No, but, I think it's
but also, great. That means I can't really do that in a Starbucks.
Yeah,
I suppose. So that needs a lot of... that involves a lot of pacing room.
I suppose. Do you think... We've not talked about pacing with anyone before. Actually, that's not true. When we spoke to... When I spoke to Tom O'Dell...
Uh-huh.
I did a podcast with Tom O'Dell. I sort of told you that earlier, didn't I? I thought that might have just come out of the blue. I did. I told you that.
I'm not sure I was listening. It is actually good new information.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I just thought you looked a bit confused.
No. I'm on board with that.
He said that he will record. He'll sometimes record what he's written and go for a walk and listen to it.
Okay.
Do you think that's something you would do?
No, I don't want to ever hear my voice. I can't even. If I'm in a studio recording of something I've written, I can't be in the studio. I've never watched anything back on telly I've written. So, no, that would be my worst thing, would be to listen back to it. So, no, I just... also, part of my process, if I'm writing a script or something, is just get to the end and don't go back. And then...
Right.
I found that if I start editing as I go, I end up in a sort of... in an infinite loop... about a third of the way through, I'm trying to really, really, really shine up a very small number of pages. What's better to do is just do a sort of zeroth draft, hammer it to the end, make a note of things that occur to you want to change, and then make the changes on the.
But I may be wrong, but I do you normally work with people when you're writing, or would you do a lot?
Depends on the project. On so a lot on my own. So you know, writing an
but
episode
with someone
of someone
that you're emailing it to someone and they're.
Is I mean,
it very rarely just you who's in control.
No, I'm never in control. They're always. I mean, if it's a TV show, then there'll always be sort of the creator of the show or the producer or the exec who is sort of, and there'll often be other writers.
Yeah.
But a lot of the process is fairly lonely. Like when I was putting the book together, that was I got the first thing out of the way before I sent it off to my. Editor, there's a lot of alone time. Obviously, in writing rooms, then you're just I like those because you're sort of trying to make
the
people
book,
laugh.
You can't have expected how well the book did, can you? The book did
no,
so well.
Yeah, no, definitely didn't expect that. Yeah. Nor did the publishers. So they sent me these emails with sort of exciting things that happened, or you know, another country's bought it, or you know, it's hit another milestone of sales.
Yeah.
And there's always this sort of untyped but definitely there sentence at the start which says, "We don't know how this has happened, but." But
it's amazing.
They're very pleased with it, but that was not the expected version of events.
Was it a case of as soon as it came out, you know, you started to notice it was doing really well, or did it take a few weeks for it to?
No, I mean it did well immediately. It was in the Sunday Times bestseller list, and it was in the
first week,
and it sort of and it was it spent the whole of its first month or 2 months in the top 10 of Amazon. So you know, it had a very good start. It was quite evident early on that something had gone unexpectedly well.
Yeah, well, it's brilliant. That's why. Were you happy with it? You must have been happy with it.
I mean, I've not read it back really. I've read like there are little sections that I read out in you know if I'm on stage.
I've seen you do that.
You have seen me do that.
Yeah.
that
sounded a bit more sinister than I intended it to sound.
There's things you know. There's lots and lots of things that I want to. Change, but now can't. That's my problem with you know seeing anything again that I've done because you know every bit of writing, whether it's going on screen or whether it's going you know going to be on like cut up trees, there's a long gestation period, and it's like we were saying before. You want to you know, you always want to evolve your show, even though you know that, you know, people are coming to see a certain show that they're expecting.
Yeah.
For me, it's the same, because, but I can't change it because it's on telly or it's in a book.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's naked baby photos, isn't it? You know they exist, but you don't want to be constantly reminded of them, and you've changed since. Actually, the paperback, which has just come out of the book, I was able to change a few bits and pieces, because when I I initially submitted my first draft of the book. It's all diary entries when I used to be a doctor, and it needed to be a mix of the funny and the sad and the, you know, and the high octane and the mundane and everything like that. The big section was stuff that's revolting.
Yes.
And my editor was very keen that the revolting stuff was minimised. She didn't use the term revolting, she said tonally adrift. Just code for revolting. And and then when the paper, and so I ended up culling a big load of stories that I loved, of really revolting things happening.
More revolting than what's in the
book? Oh, much more revolting than what's in the book. And so when the paperback came out,
was that? Can you say any of them?
Yeah, I'll say one in a second. I'll go and get the paperback, because I had a bit more clout after however many hundreds of thousands of books have been printed.
Yeah.
I'm no longer like this sort of a new first-time author. They now have to sort of...
Listen to you.
Not so much pretend to listen to me. Or sort of... No, indulge me. They now have to indulge me, even if they disagree.
Yeah.
So I was able to... squeak in a few of... A few of those.
Proper dirt.
Oh, hang on. I'll go and get...
Go and grab it. Yeah, yeah, that'd be good. Just for what, if people are wondering what that crunching on the floor is, Adam's kitchen is covered in brown paper.
Yeah, it's a sex thing. And we've got builders
involved in the
sex thing.
Yeah, great. So this is the new paperback.
Yes.
That's got even more revolting stories.
Yeah.
Does it say that on the front?
Or? It doesn't. No, I wanted that. But they said, extra with extra diary entries, which is code for extra disgusting.
It's the after-hours version.
Do you want me to Jack and Ori this?
What's the worst one in there?
I don't know if this is the worst one. This is... I think this is my... This is a real favourite. This is the one I was saddest when it got cut, and this was from the 17th of May, 2005.
Okay.
Patient CF has held the record for worst item inserted into penis for 3 months, but now, sadly, his reign has come to an end. I was fairly confident that squirting a cork gun down his urethra would have provided him with an unassailable lead, but every bleep from A&E is a potential kingmaker, and we saw a new ruler crowned today. Patient RD is a 27-year-old gentleman who attempted a new twist on an old classic to surprise his girlfriend on her birthday. He stripped naked, lay on his back on the kitchen table, and smeared his body with chocolate sauce. He achieved an erection, which is a medical expression that's always surprised me. Yeah, it's a pretty small achievement in the scheme of things, isn't it? He achieved an erection, then inserted and lit a thin green birthday candle. Unfortunately, which is a word that appears a lot in this book, his girlfriend didn't get a chance to see this ill-advised yet imaginative birthday tribute, as the patient soon dissolved into the excruciating pain of hot wax dripping through his urethra and into his bladder. I presume as he blew out the candle, he made a wish that the urology department would have a good plan as to how to remove a stick of wax melted deep into his cock.
Oh my god!
So I mean, yeah, there's those.
So they're added in the new paperback.
Yeah,
I can sort of see why that wasn't in the first copy. To be honest, as much as I enjoyed that story,
It's quite bad.
It's quite bad.
Yeah. Mm. Do you think that's the worst one?
I mean, I don't know.
Is that the worst thing you saw as a doctor? You've probably been asked this all the time. Is that the worst thing you saw as a doctor?
No. Well, it depends. It's. I worked on a labour ward, yeah. So you know, which you know you end up with twice the number of patients you start with in general, which yeah. is a good batting average. It's generally a happy place, but when it's a sad place, you know, you see absolutely terrible rough. Things. You know,
yeah.
you know, if you when you lose mums and lose babies, you never forget that. So that's the harrowing answer to your question.
Yeah.
But the most repulsive thing I saw, the one that still haunts me, and I was glad to be able to share with the world, was also from my, because before my vagina days, I had a lot of penis days working as a urologist, and this was basically...
Just to clarify what you mean by that.
You
were a gynecologist, you didn't used to be a woman.
Oh no, I didn't used to be, used to be.
Just to clear that up. Just for Joel's purposes.
Yeah, exactly, for the tape. No, but you know, far and away, the most disgusting thing I saw was a man. The term is degloving, which means the skin and associated blood vessels get ripped off something. Degloving his penis.
Oh God!
Slid down a lamppost. He was 18, so he was 18 and slid down a lamppost, and his penis shredded off, leaving him with like a sort of a thin bit of spaghetti.
What happened? How did you fix it?
No, I imagine to this day it remains, you know, if we imagine that a penis has two functions, it's only going to be that good for one of them.
Oh, man.
And even that involves sort of a spigot.
Did you, on those, when things like that happened and there was something sad, would you get the saxophone out to cheer people up?
Yeah, and no, I'd always keep it in the locker room.
Did they enjoy it?
I was the Patch Adams of
another
gynae cancer. Oh, no, come on.
You need to update your saxophonist reference.
No, that wasn't it. That was Patch Adams was a Robin Williams.
We heard of
Robin
Williams. Yes.
Oh, yeah, so sort of film
yes,
where he
I
was
know
there.
Who Robin Williams is, Adam.
All right. That's just the you know, the Bob Holmes debacle earlier on made me slightly question it.
That was a low point. I'm honest, that was a low point. I remember talking to you about America once.
Oh, right.
And we were talking about working in America.
Oh, yes.
And you said that you would move out to America and live and work out there if an opportunity presented itself. Is that still the way you feel? This was before the book success. And
I mean, opportunities have presented themselves. Unfortunately, I don't exist in a vacuum, and my boyfriend's got a job in West London, and the commute from LA to Shepherd's Bush is just, I mean, it's doable, but beyond a couple of days, it's a proper faff. Now, I've been very lucky with working in America, but I've been able to do quite a lot of it remotely. But the book has certainly kept me busy for the last 6 months or so.
Do you think that there's a big difference between the TV industry that you work in here and the TV industry in America? If you were to go over there and work, there would be a massive difference.
Well, I mean, I do go over there, not infrequently. The writer is taken more seriously as, you know, within the hierarchy of the television show in the States. And a part of that is the writer also is better paid often there.
They have like huge writer's rooms, don't they? Sometimes when you watch American shows at the end when the credits come down, and it says writers, it's like 14 writers.
Yeah, and you've watched the show and there were three jokes and it just feels like an easy job.
But it seems like here things are written by like two or three people.
It's a money thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's more money in the system. Although it's sort of equilibrating slightly now in that American money is coming into productions written in the UK, made in the UK. And so, yes, I mean, there's less of a difference now than there was. It's a bit... I don't love LA as a place. My biggest problem with moving out to write would just be I don't love LA. It doesn't have any soul.
Yeah, that's why I think you. That's why I thought you would.
That's
why
I thought
LA.
I'd be good there.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a good point. And and also, it's so big and spread out.
Again, a reason I thought you might have liked it.
It was, but it's like you can't, you know, walk to the shops to get a bottle of rum or something. You have to get a, you know, 9-minute Uber.
Most people would use milk as a reference point there, wouldn't
What's
they?
That?
I went to LA for the first time like 2 months ago.
Oh, right.
I did like it, but I guess maybe it would become, there are aspects of it that I think if you lived there would become a bit wary.
Yes.
But for a week, it's fun, isn't it? But I don't think maybe...
Yeah.
The driving
everywhere
thing is annoying, isn't it?
Yes, it's sort of... It's Telly's Disneyland, isn't it?
But it's great. But
it's good for a long weekend, but
yeah.
If you had to spend 3 months at Disneyland, eventually...
But I met up with this guy who works up there as a TV producer, and I was asking him about if he prefers working there to here, and he said it's just more... you know, opportunities, and what he would be working on here is, you know, maybe like an ITV2 panel show.
The sort of show you're on.
Exactly.
Jesus Christ. Exactly. Poor man.
Exactly. The sort
Poor
of thing
man. Oh, but, no, he was right to get out. He was right to get out. So I'm with him on that. But, I think the joy of the stuff I do is you would never appear in it.
I think that's unfair. I think I would like to be in something you... Maybe in
Would you want to star in the TV adaptation of my book?
Could I be the guy whose penis is degloved?
Gladly, yeah.
But
I don't think you can pass for 18 though anymore. Whatever it says in your Twitter bio, and doubtless your Tinder bio.
This is a problem that I found over because I did some gigs in LA, right? And the guys hosting the shows obviously didn't know who I was. But they'd obviously Googled me to find out how to introduce me. And the first thing that came up was obviously some information from when I was 18. So they all introduced
How young you are.
They all introduced me as being like 16 years old.
Yeah.
And I had to... I just don't look 16 anymore.
Yeah.
I'm not 16 anymore.
You're not. You're ageing pretty badly.
Yeah.
Not to say, I don't know if it was LA, but you've gained a good 3 years in the last in the last year or so. You're sort of really catching up with yourself.
I know.
But it's Daniel Sloss syndrome, isn't it? When your niche is being
that cutting remark there.
when your thing is when your niche is being very young.
Yeah.
What do you do when you're 30?
I agree, but that's why I think it's important not to make that your niche.
It was very good for you because it excused quite a lot of the jokes,
sure,
didn't it?
Yeah,
they were
yeah,
like,
sure.
"Oh, he's only 12."
Exactly.
Dude, isn't that good? Wasn't that good? So now, now you need the material.
It's definitely something that I've benefited from and probably still do.
Yeah, because you haven't changed your Twitter bio.
Well, it says my age, doesn't it?
Well, not your age now. It says your age. That's the problem.
Say 18 on my Twitter bio.
How old are you?
21.
Like, fuck you. Are you really only 21?
Yeah. How old do you think I am?
I feel like 23.
No, 21.
Man alive. Hang on. What's your Twitter?
Yeah.
Do I follow you?
I really hope so.
Okay.
You do?
Oh, no, I do. I do. Oh, yeah. 21. No, sorry.
Did you think it said 18?
I do apologise. You're... You know, that was... You do have your... Can I see some ID?
Yeah, you can, yeah. But I do... But I think you're right. It is a problem if you... Although there are some acts, without wishing to name names, that definitely have strung out the youth thing for years.
But if you were wishing to name names, who would you say, other than Daniel?
Well, there's one act who I heard who... with his like tour posters, will use pictures from like 10 years ago.
Oh yeah, no, we all use.
No, but like.
I mean, look at this photo of me in the book.
Yeah, no, I know, but I mean, not like a good photo, like a.
I mean, that's.
That is preposterous.
I mean, that's.
Yeah. When was that taken? Was that at university?
I think even earlier
that's
than that.
That's the photo that's used for all of your stuff, I've noticed, isn't it?
Oh yeah, so for example, yeah. You know, use a flattering, flattering picture. Why wouldn't you?
No, I know, but the guy I'm talking about is. Like properly, like 15 years ago, photo.
Who is it?
For the purposes of it's Russell Howard. For the purposes.
Russell Howard.
But
yes.
That's what I mean. He still does the youth thing, and he's almost 40 now.
Sure.
And he's still t-shirts, and I'm a young guy, and it works. Obviously, you know, I'm not having a go. He works really well.
It does. I mean, as time and time again, the industry proves there's a lot of idiots out there.
Yeah, I suppose.
Although, Russell, I did very much appreciate appearing on your
show,
and it did sell a lot of books.
So that's quite rude, actually, to say
that's quite ungrateful, isn't it?
Do you feel, without wishing to make this sound too serious, are you happy?
Yes.
With where you are in your life and your career?
I'm very happy. Yeah. I spent a long time being unhappy because of my job, when my job was medicine, just because I had no work-life balance and I wasn't in control, like I was saying before, at all. Or maybe I wasn't saying before, if that's one of the bits you cut out because I slag off a person you're working with. So as I may or may not have said before, depending on the edit, I'm now in control of my life. I'm in a happy relationship. I'm in a nice sort of
we get on
setup.
Well, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
It's nice.
We do. I'm
you don't
I'm
seem
happy.
To have, because of all the friends I have in the industry, you seem like one of the most grounded people.
Is that because I don't do gigs?
Possibly. Genuinely, possibly that is what it is.
It's very easy to go.
You seem very
insane.
You seem like you've got a good attitude and you don't take it too seriously or get too het up.
You can't take it too seriously because it's just nonsense, isn't it? It's not life or death.
Well, your stuff is, yeah.
Yeah.
Some of us take it seriously, yeah.
It's, you know, a bad day at work means that, you know, everyone walks out of your show again or, you know... Or I dip out of the top 10 one week. You know, it's... It's...
Books, not singles, by the way.
No, you know, no one dies. And
yeah, no,
I think one of the... Probably, the biggest thing medicine has taught me is that, you know, shit happens. But it's just like the other day, someone... I got back to my car, come back from a literary festival in Wales, and I was in the service station. There was a piece of paper on the windscreen of my car, and someone had said really, really sorry and left their phone number. And down the side on the passenger side, there was a big scrape. I was like, oh, fuck's sake. But it's only a bit of tin. It'll you know, that can be polished out or replaced or whatever, and there's good in the world because someone left their number.
Yeah.
As it turns out, they left a completely fucking made up number.
Really.
And my excess is about £1,000, so I ended up paying for
it.
So amazing. So I mean that.
Someone who was in the audience at the literary festival.
But I think I'm now more zen than I would have been if I went into comedy at whatever you claim your age is.
12.
Exactly. Better put your clothes on then, mate.
Yeah, great. Because I think it's quite hard to... I don't know from your experience. It seems a lot of people who work in entertainment in whatever form that is seem to constantly be quite... unhappy with where they are and wanting to further their career or...
Yeah.
So I think to achieve what you just said, where you actually feel contented.
Yeah, there's a brilliant producer who gave me actually my first writing break on telly years ago, called Stephen McCrum, who execed Mongrels, which was this sort of adult puppet show where I just did my first bit of telly. And he believes and tells everyone about the law of abundance. There's enough success for everyone.
Yeah.
Just because someone else is successful, don't be jealous of them, because you can do that as well.
Yeah.
And there just is. You don't need to push someone else down to get up. There's enough for everyone. And something I've found, you know, when I, you know, on the occasions I am in the green room of a comedy bill, there's a lot of how did you get that? Meaning, why did you get that?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of you know, jealousy is not a cool thing, and it's difficult to get over that. But you know, it's all done on merit, and you know, if you work at your thing, you'll get it.
Yeah.
You know, your script will get made. Even your script could get made.
Well, that's maybe a little too far-fetched.
No, but I'm trying to be like positive and uplifting for the end of the podcast.
I think that's got a really weird attitude that a lot of people seem to have of not just I want to be successful, but I want to be successful and want no one else to be successful.
Yes.
Not just, do you know what I mean? It's
yes.
a very, really weird attitude.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but that seems to be quite a well-trodden viewpoint in this industry of not just, you know, sort of like a fuck everyone else sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always thought it's quite odd.
It is, and you probably don't see it amongst... You certainly don't see it amongst doctors.
No, it's sort of, you want, one of the only industries with this like that.
Yeah, but it's an unusual personality who wants everyone to love them, wants to go on stage and be lauded. And a lot of people, if they write it down secretly in their diary, a lot of their dream is to be extraordinarily famous and have their own... you know, primetime chat show, or be doing their own arena
podcast.
Tours that sell them, or yes, to a lesser extent, a podcast.
Yeah.
This is your arena tour.
Yeah.
But that's not. It's not a normal. It's not a standard thing. But I think that personality, you know, is often allied to that feeling. But another reason I don't do a huge number of gigs is that green room thing, because you know, given that my main thing is, you know, is writing stuff, and a lot of comics obviously want to do that alongside us or as their next thing. There's a lot of, would you mind if I send you my script? Which is fine. Obviously, I do mind, but you know, it only takes half an hour to read a 30-page script, and you know if it's any good. You know, pretty much by the time you've read the first page or two. But now I'm getting a bit of, can I send you my book?
Yeah.
No.
I imagine you're getting a lot of that.
It's a 300-page Word document. Of course you can't send me that.
Do you say no? Or?
It's very... Yes. No, I do say no.
Yeah.
I mean, and I guess
that's better than saying yes and then not reading it.
I get... Or they'll send it to me and I'll say I've read the first couple of chapters. But I do get... As soon as you've had a book out, people want your... quote on the front of books. I mean, that's you know, people do judge a book by its cover. So my one, we've got Stephen Fry and Jonathan Ross and Charlie Brooker and Dawn French. So
that is,
and I shamelessly, you know, contacted people, sent them my book. So I don't want to be the douchebag who doesn't read anyone's books, because I've relied quite heavily on nice people saying nice things about my book.
Do you think the quotes on books make a big difference?
It's validation of some point. So now because the hardback's already been out, we can say that is the awards it's won and it's been a bestseller and we've got newspaper reviews. But before then, you know, if some celebrity, what you like, has been nice about a book, that might be the thing you need to read. I think it does. I know, particularly if a writer I like says they like a book, I will, you know... If I'm looking for a book, if I'm in, you know, Smiths or Falls or Waterstones or whatever at the airport, that would be the one I go for, because, It's like a recommendation from a friend. It's not quite as good, but an author I love, you know, if John Niven or someone tells me that I should read this book, then I... And it's like on Twitter.
Or David Walliams or someone like that.
I know you read a lot of his books, but I've got a slightly higher reading age. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm 12, just to clarify.
So, you know, but I see someone tweeting about a... I don't often like book tickets to gigs because someone said, oh, make sure you catch me at the Soho Theatre, to use a random example, Tom Lucy. But I will quite often, if someone says, read this amazing book, and I'm following them because I like them, you know, sort of, you know, next time in a bookshop, buy that, or just, you know, click on the link or whatever. So, I think it's made a difference, but who knows?
Obviously, don't talk about stuff that you're not supposed to, but I presume you're writing another book.
I am writing another book, yeah.
Is it along the same lines?
Yeah, so its working title is 100 Patients Who Changed My Life, and it's about the quite dry, but hopefully less dry in the execution sounding idea that every action has an equal and opposite reaction, like they teach you in... you remember from GCSE physics last month.
Action, reaction.
So when you're breaking bad news to a patient, it has an effect on you as a doctor. And if someone circumcises themselves accidentally using masking tape, then I can use that endlessly in dinner party anecdotes.
Great. I think that's everything I wanted to talk to you about.
It's certainly everything I wanted to say.
Yeah, I'm sure. The saxophone thing, is that a go?
Yeah, I mean, let me see if I can find one.
Adam's just gone to get his saxophone.
I mean, you could probably cut that bit out, couldn't you?
No, I like that bit.
There, you like that?
Are you okay?
Yeah, sorry, it's right to the back of the upstairs cupboard.
You sound like you fell over there. You sound like you degloved yourself. Oh, wow. This is so exciting.
Did you think this was a bluff?
No. I don't know what I thought. Oh, wow. Oh, Adam, it's huge. Just without any context, but this is it. Adam.
So, I need to include the caveat at this point that I was very good at the saxophone when I was 13 and 14.
Right.
And it has mostly been in a cupboard for the intervening years.
When was the last time you blew on it? Is that the right verb?
Yeah, I mean, I played it is normally... So I don't want to get too technical, too jargony. The last time I played it, years.
Wow. What an exclusive.
An exclusive!
This is very exciting. Okay, what are you going to play for us? Can you play something nice that we can sort of fade out with? You can very quickly fade out.
You can do a crash fade on. I have a go at Baker Street.
Yes, huge.
I mean, I'm not sure I know how it...
You know how it goes.
I know how it goes, which is different to knowing what fingers to put where to make what noise.
Sure.
So I don't know if this reed works. I mean, there's a lot of variables. Oh,
wow.
It's
so exciting.
Okay, hang on, I just need to. Okay. I'll play it over here.
There we go, Adam K, ladies and gentlemen. A big thank you to Adam for having me round to his house for that chat. We had a lot of fun. And also a big thank you to Joel Grove, who produces the show, to Will Shahada for the editing, and to my manager, Rick Hughes, for all your help. Thank you to you for listening. It's been a lot of fun. We've got some really amazing guests coming up in the next few weeks. So please subscribe to the show on iTunes, give it 5 stars, tell your friends, you know the drill. Thank you very much for listening. See you next week.